Welcome back to the Rise and Scribe podcast. My guest today is Lee Jenkins, senior writer from Sports Illustrated. Lee joins us to talk about his pieces on Anthony Davis, Nick Young, and LeBron James.
Well, we'll start with the Nick Young one, because it's interesting because it's the two of us. So the Davis and the Young one are both basically opposites. Or not about opposites, but they're completely different in terms of subject, because one's about, you know, an ascension to stardom, and the other's more kind of character deep dive, I guess. Would that be the right characterization?
Yeah, personality profile, something like that.
Yeah. What spurred the idea behind the Young article?
You know, Salman was an editor mentioning it, and sometimes I think, you know, the best stories just come from someone who seems interesting. You know, I think it's sometimes important to remember that, you know, writing an article about a guy isn't—it's not an award. It's not as though he has to be, you know, the best player in the league, or you know, the stats don't have to necessarily drive it. Sometimes a good personality is so refreshing in sports, or, you know, a character. And, you know, I think a lot of times, probably 20, 30 years ago, you saw characters in sports more often. You know, guys like Deion Sanders and Brian Bosworth, and today they're pretty rare. So, you know, when one emerges like Nick Young, whether it's completely organic or a little bit organic and a little bit manufactured, I think sometimes it's worth exploring sort of the genesis, you know, behind the character and why it exists. Sometimes then you find that there's a three-dimensional person. I mean, you always find there's a three-dimensional person, but sometimes you find that there are some kind of rich life experiences that inform that character.
That's interesting that you brought up the organic or semi-organic or manufactured, because to me, Young's personality, there always seemed to be something manufactured about it. But then, you know, reading your story, it seemed like it's a lot more organic than, I guess, what I originally thought.
I think it is. I mean, I think there's an element of fame-seeking with a lot of guys, and I think, you know, sort of the ways he's played up the character and the swaggy P persona in L.A., I think is a way that he's trying to take advantage of it, and sort of, you know, I hate that word brand, but kind of grow this notion of Swaggy P that probably won't be grown by anything he does on the basketball court. It's more just by his personality and the way he is. But, you know, I find with most of these guys, I've done stories like this where players have these sort of alter egos and, you know, different kind of personas. And you often find that they're rooted in some reality. And I think that with Young, the kind of Swaggy P persona is something he feels like he needs to tap into as a player. It connotes confidence and freedom and flair, and that's the way he plays best. And even though he'll never be a star, I still think that's kind of an interesting thing to explore, sort of, you know, the way a person has to feel, or sort of that kind of face they have to put on to play at their best. Because that's true for, you know, it's true for Kobe, for instance, like, you know, one of the best players his generation. He has to kind of maintain this sort of killer persona. That's what he plays best, quite literally, with his teeth clenched. LeBron, different. He has to feel like he's kind of having fun out there and being joyful on the court. So even though Nick Young clearly is not even remotely at their level, I think that's interesting, sort of how guys kind of channel a certain feeling and how that kind of maximizes or diminishes the way they play.
It's interesting that you say it, because we were this week on Paroxysm, we've been doing Style Week, and one of the things I wrote was about how a player's personality will inform the way they play, or it'll inevitably come out in some manner. Was Young's personality what you expected off the court?
You know, whenever you have kind of these very flamboyant guys, usually it's different, because we see them most of the time in front of cameras, a ton of people surrounding them, and they play up to it. When you're one-on-one with them for an extended time, this is the same way with Dwight Howard. It's not as though they suddenly become demure and quiet, but they're not what they were, and you can engage them in kind of a more serious way, and that was definitely the case for him as well. So was he like what I expected? Yeah, he was. But it's not all zaniness. You know, I'm at the guy's house. It's like, he's not, you know, there's a degree of playing up to the cameras that I think a lot of you know, a lot of those sort of players who verge on the more silly or flamboyant side do. And when they're away from it, it's different. But, you know, you touched on a point a second ago about players' personalities coming out in their games, and it's something I'm kind of fascinated with because I think it's so true. I mean, I think, you know, you look at a guy like Rondo, for instance, and the way he plays is so much like the way he is, sort of the mathematical mind and kind of looking at things completely differently. And, you know, and you have people who are unselfish who play unselfishly. You have people who kind of have a real ego about themselves and carry themselves like alpha dogs playing that way, you know, needing to score all the time. I mean, I find that so interesting about the NBA. I don't think it's really true for other sports, but the way they play is so often an expression of themselves. It's not always the case, but it usually is.
Well, I think it's also hard for, like, guys in the NFL or MLB, simply because of their sport, it doesn't allow them to really have much expression in terms of their play, whereas, you know, basketball, it's very much an expressive sport. I think that it has that in common with soccer.
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, their personalities are more on display, and you're right. They can, you know, in those other sports, you're just trying to get by. You're trying to succeed. You can't necessarily sort of determine how you want your game to look. Like I remember writing about, you know, when the Lakers were really rolling, I thought a lot about Gasol and Odom. And those were two guys who clearly, you know, they had an idea of what they wanted basketball to look like. You know, they had a sense of it, what they liked about basketball. You know, the way Powell plays is what Powell likes to see and what he likes basketball to be. That's a real luxury for an athlete to be able to kind of match it to his wishes. And Lamar was the same way. You know, he had a feeling of what you should be as a basketball player based on growing up watching Magic and, you know, trying to highlight his teammates at an early age because he got so much attention so early and wanted them to kind of get some shine. And for better or worse, kind of those life experiences and their personalities definitely led to their styles.
Have you encountered a player whose personality on the court matches not at all with their off the court personality?
Yeah, you know, I have. I'm trying to think of who that would most be like. Because most of them, it does line up. Like Westbrook, the way he plays would kind of remind you of the way he is. You know, one guy I feel like sometimes is Harden is a little bit different. You know, when you talk to Harden, he can be very reserved. And, you know, you don't really get the sense of that same flamboyance that you would think there would be with his beard and, you know, with even his kind of the way he plays. So, like, the way he plays is so colorful and, you know, it's so dynamic. And his personality is kind of more reserved than that. But, you know, sometimes the other thing is that you don't always really get a sense. I mean, as a media member, you try to know sort of what they're like, you know, what a subject's like, what a personality's like. But, in, you know, a lot of times I'm sitting with a guy for 45 minutes. I can't really pretend that I, you know him in any meaningful way. I'm just trying to kind of glean as much as I can in that limited time.
Is that tough to do, I guess, as a writer to hold, and as a feature writer and profiler, to kind of hold back on your own, I don't know, about intuitions or, like, what you think about this player?
Yeah, it is. Because I get really uncomfortable when you kind of get too deep into somebody's head, especially if they're not, you know, your usher in that. If they are, you know, when they're willing to take you there, that's fine. And even when people close to them are willing to take you there a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, connecting those dots, I think, is one of the most dangerous things that we do, you know, trying to kind of say too much about who a person is or what they're like. I mean, I've done that in the past and been burned by it. You know, you think you sort of have somebody pegged and you don't. And, you know, making those kind of broad determinations, too, about, you know, people's character, or, you know, the motives behind things that they did, you just often can get burned by that. So, no, it's definitely something that, like, you learn over time to play it safe. And, you know, if you're going to talk about what's in somebody's head, usually it's best if it comes from them.
Right, right. Going back to the Young piece for a second, I noticed you got a really great quote from Ronnie Price, which surprised me because I didn't, I wouldn't think to go and talk to Ronnie Price about someone. Did you know he was a good quote before? How do you approach those bench guys or like the guys that you wouldn't really think to go talk to?
I mean, you kind of know around the league, there are just some players who, and really every team has a couple of them. They're guys on the bench who've been around usually, and they're just really perceptive people. They're really insightful people, and they would be in, whatever career they chose. And Ronnie Price is one of those. And just, I live in Los Angeles. I'm around the Lakers. So I've talked to him a couple times before, and you just know that a guy like that is going to share insight. Earl Watson is like that. There's just players around the league who are like that. And Jamal Crawford is like that. Pat Barnes. I mean, there are a bunch of guys, and they're not always who you'd expect. But people who kind of give you a little bit different perspective. And the reason I went to him, honestly, is I was trying to explore just sort of this idea, when teams are bad and there's a lot of losing, it's like they have to hang their head in the locker room after every game. All the reporters go in there. You need to be just, there needs to be an air of disappointment. It's almost funereal. And I get that. That's the way it has to be. They're in a competitive undertaking. But at the same time, I think there's an interesting disconnect because their lives are all fantastic. They're all at the top 0.01% of what they do. They make, untold riches. They have in general great lives. They're at the pinnacle, and yet they also in some ways are at the basement, given like on a team like the Lakers, for instance, that's losing. And I think Young sort of is an interesting way into that, that thought, just because he seems to clearly have, I think he cares when they lose. I think he's upset when they lose, but I also think he has a certain perspective about him that sort of, this underlying feeling of, this is an incredible ride, and it's been an incredible success for someone who came from very little and essentially rescued his family.
So it's kind of that keeping the mentality that it really is just a game, like despite all the glamour and everything.
Well, it's what it kind of means to each one of them personally. It's like there's so much. I was just around the Cavaliers a few minutes ago. I was shoot around, and they're a team clearly in crisis. It's an immeasurable disappointment, and yet if you go through individually to each one, they're all just such incredible success stories. So kind of maintaining that perspective, but also keeping the hunger of winning, trying to succeed within it. I think it's just interesting. That idea of kind of. You don't want to be complacent. You also never want to lose sight of the fact that these guys all have it pretty good. Right. The way we kind of cover a team like the Lakers, for instance, is just this season. They've clearly been a disaster. It just seems so hopeless. It seems there's so much kind of despair in the overall tone of it. And yet, when you talk about the individuals, I think privately, deep down, they must be thinking at all times, but look at what, look at what each one of us accomplished individually. When you look at it through the prism of their families, their childhoods, where they came from, it's just an interesting disconnect. In some ways you're a big loser because you play for a team that's not winning. And in other ways you are, in the main way that's probably more crucial, you are an immense winner.
When you talk to his family, is it ever tough to talk to, I guess, a family? I guess on this, it's better because this is a success story. But, do you talk to the family first? Did you talk to them second, after you talked to Young?
I talk to family after I talk to the subject usually, just because I don't feel real comfortable approaching family without the subject's okay or their knowledge of it. I just think that's kind of a private deal, like with coaches, right. High school coaches, teammates, friends. I think that's fine to kind of go in early. I usually do the family afterward. And they were easy to talk to because they're Nick Young's family. Of course they're going to be, outgoing people and enjoy talking and not be afraid of tape recorders, microphones, or anything like that. These are people who, you know, as you'd expect, it's like they came to Los Angeles from Milwaukee, you know, wanted to be famous like their son. And the dad was an actor and mom was a model and she was beauty pageants when she was younger. So, you know, these are not kind of camera shy individuals that you'd expect when you have a son like Nick Young. So, no, they were great. You know, not every family, like not every player is great to deal with. Not every family is great to deal with. But in general, I think usually, especially in a situation like these in the NBA, most families are inherently proud of, you know, obviously of where their son has come from and where he's made it to, even if within the sphere of the NBA, they're all struggling in some way.
Did you go into this piece when you assigned it, did you go into it with any sort of, this is going to be the angle of my story, or was this one that you wanted to wait and talk to Young first to see kind of where this is going to go?
No, I mean, I think with anybody who kind of is sort of a jester, you know, if that, when that's kind of the identity, I always think that's inherently going to be interesting because you just want to know sort of why, where did that come from? Where did you start playing that role? You know, was there, and usually with folks like that, you know, there's something, there's a reason, there's something, there's maybe an underlying, you know, sadness or something that happened early in their life that, you know, made them kind of cover pain in that way of laughter, making other people happy. I had a sense of some of that. I knew a little bit of his backstory. You don't know it until you talk to the person. Yeah, you know, sometimes I have, you know, little theses like that that are totally wrong. I remember once running a theory I had by Joakim Noah like that about himself, and he just looked at me and said, nope. that can happen. Like, I run these theories sometimes by, you know, by somebody I'm interviewing, and sometimes they say no, and sometimes they kind of nod and extrapolate a little bit. So you never really know. You're just trying to, you know, try to test some things out. You know, in this case, I think that experience with his, you know, lost brother was shot and killed when he was very young, kind of growing up in this with this family that had kind of the dark cloud over it. You know, one of his brothers went to a mental institution. You know, even his mom talked about, you know, considering suicide. One of his brothers moved away, you know, all because of this one tragic event. I definitely think there was an element where Nick Young felt like he had to be kind of the bright light for everybody, which meant basketball success later, but I think originally it just meant being a really happy, really happy, fun guy.
Is that always,
you know, whether he was feeling it or not.
Is that always an interesting discovery process for you?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, there's actually a documentary done about him,
right?
Second Chance Season. It was great, and it was done when he was in high school. So, you know, it helps when you have a little of that, you know, source material to go off, and then you start talking to other people and coaches, and you sort of, you know, start to form kind of what you think is a, you know, maybe a theory on why somebody is the way they are, and then you run it by the subject. But if you said no, that, you know, that's really not, then I probably would have, you know, had to go in a little bit different direction. But, you know, with Young too, I mean, you know, we're kind of talking about, you know, sort of those, that just childhood events. But part of it is, you know, sometimes you just want to tell a fun story and something and have a character, a main character who just has a lot of, you know, funny things around them. It's just, I think it's something that's refreshing for a reader. Like when you go through our magazine, go through other kind of long feature stories, so often they're, you know, they're sad, they're about people overcoming immense adversity, and those are great stories, and I try to write those, a ton of those myself, but once in a while, it's nice to get one that's really funny. You know, some of the most memorable stories I've ever read, or, and I'm not saying I wrote one of those, but it's definitely, the goal was to write something that was more humorous, just because I think that's who he is. And, you know, like Tom Verducci for us once wrote a story about Ricky Henderson, and wrote one like Kevin Mitchell, and they were just basically, you know, 5,000 words of hilarious anecdotes, one after another, about those guys and their playing careers. And, you know, those are two of the stories that stuck with me as much as, you know, some of the Gary Smith stories, which are more serious and dramatic.
Is that something refreshing for you as a writer to be able to tell those stories, not just kind of go through the whole, you know, started from the bottom stories, to be able to get these good, like, character type features?
Yeah, it's just fun. It's like anytime you can get Gilbert Arenas in there, and you know, anecdotes about wearing his furs and, you know, paintball guns and, you know, buying laptops on his black card and stuff like that. I mean, it's just, yeah, I mean, what's fun for a reader is usually fun for a writer. So you're just kind of picturing, you know, people who follow the NBA kind of, laughing. That's the,
right.
You know, they always say, it's kind of a total cliche, but writers say, like, you know, you're trying to make somebody laugh or cry. So, you know, I'll take either option. If I can get one or get the other, I'll be happy. So, in this case, it's probably more, definitely more laughter than tears with Nick Young, I think. And again, it's just, you know, a lot of people have said, like, this guy's only scoring 13 points a game or whatever, is in this massive shooting slump. And, you know, that's all true. I'm not trying to make the case he's an all-star. But I think that, you know, sometimes the personalities in our sports are worth highlighting, even if maybe their stat lines aren't.
We're going to shift gears a bit and go to the Davis story that you wrote, which is kind of the opposite of what we've been talking about in terms of Price's story. What struck you most about Davis? Had you talked to him before this?
I hadn't talked to him. He was a really engaging guy. It was a totally different kind of thing. You know, with Young, it's like, he's eager to, clearly he's eager to be in the spotlight. He enjoys it. You know, it was through the Lakers, you know, under the Lakers. So they're a team that is, you know, really eager to promote their players always. That's part of the reason they are. You know, there are a lot of reasons that they are the brand they are. I mean, the winning is a big part of it. LA is a big part of it. But they also, you know, they're really eager to let their players kind of be themselves and let them put themselves out there and be known, really, by the public. And I think that's part of the reason, you know, the Lakers are the Lakers, even when they're struggling. You know, with Davis, it was a little different. It was a... it was a tighter time frame. I was talking to him in 45 minutes. I was at the Pelicans facility, so it's not as exactly as a, you know, not as much kind of access or freedom as it was with somebody like Nick Young. But also, Davis is much younger, 21 years old. He is a blossoming superstar. He's definitely being, you know, handled, treated like a massive superstar already. And, you know, he seemed like a down-to-earth guy. I mean, I don't want to make too many... only making too many judgments about a person. I think that what was, you know, what's still interesting about him, even though it's fairly known, is just how he really did come out of nowhere. And I think what's interesting about that is you can kind of go two ways with that. Like, if you come out of nowhere in your life, if you're basically in 12th grade, 11th grade, and all of a sudden you go from completely unknown, just like a regular kid, to the best recruit in the country, you can be like one of those lotto winners, the Powerball winners, who gets all this money and just blows through it, you know, and it's just a complete mess, kind of like an overnight Hollywood sensation. Or you can go another way and kind of remember that time when you weren't big time, when you weren't the number one recruit, and it can kind of humble you and ground you in a way. You know, from being with Davis and talking to people around him, I think he's chosen that latter avenue. I think that's, you know, what he's on. And I think that bodes really well for himself, for the Pelicans, for the league, because clearly he's one of these players who, you know, few bigs really resonate with the public. And, you know, it's just hard for them, I think, to become like as big a stars as wings, as point guards. But Davis is just different because of the way he plays, how athletic he is, the look of his back. It's not just a big, but, you know, almost like get on that Durant type level, even though obviously he doesn't shoot like Durant. So I thought it was, it's just nice being able to, you know, get to see somebody when they're really on the verge. And it feels like Anthony Davis is, if he's not on the verge, he's already crossed over, you know, to getting to that top five type level.
It was really interesting. Yeah, he's not. It's not necessarily that he's a private person. It's just you don't really know a lot about him so far. So it was really interesting to me to see how much of a not a kid, but how like young he still is in terms of like, you know, he still draws. He does the whole that he regales Pelicans with Magic Tricks. That was really surprising to me.
He's only 21. You know, he's such a baby. He's just, you know, a lot of these guys, they, you know, a guy like that, he's living out near the facility. You know, it's like playing a lot of video games, hanging out with friends, going to the facility, basketball, back home, more basketball. You know, and that's kind of the lifestyle a lot of, I think a lot of players have going back to AAU, the hotel, the gym, back to the hotel. So I think that's, you know, that's kind of where he is. And, you know, as he goes on, he'll probably expand his interests and, you know, become completely, next time I talk to him, if I get to, he'll, you know, I'm sure he'll be totally different in a few years. But for right now, he very much is still on the verge. And sometimes, you know, when you're writing features about players, it's like, it always helps when they've had a little more life. Like, I always feel like usually when guys are, you know, 27, 28, they start to become like really good feature subjects. You know, they've sort of had some time to reflect, because all of these guys have gone through just extraordinary journeys. You know, a lot of them have been known since they were 14 or 15 years old. You know, they hit this genetic lottery ticket. You know, how they handled that is interesting. They're able to kind of reflect on it in a way. So he's still at that age where he did reflect on it, but it's just, it's different. He's still in it. I mean, it was like only, what, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, he was a nobody. You know, his only offer was Cleveland State. And so to me, just, even though it's been said, just kind of exploring, you know, how that ascent, that completely rapid ascent, informed sort of how he's informing his next ascent, which is happening right now, or happened maybe 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. I thought was interesting. That was something I wanted to go in and get him to reflect on a little bit.
Do you think you got that from him? Did you get what you want in terms of that insight?
Yeah, I did. Because I think he, you know, I talked to his parents a little bit, to his dad a little bit. I definitely think that, you know, everybody felt as though that experience helped him, because he didn't think of himself as a prodigy. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's not as though every prodigy, I mean, you know, I just saw the biggest prodigy of all, Cap Shootaround, and saw LeBron. And, you know, there are other prodigies who, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that they're going to go bust or anything. And there are people who become famous overnight who do go bust. But I think for Davis specifically, the fact that he's able to remember a time so clearly when he wasn't a star, I think it's a little bit of why he plays so hard, you know, and so much is made of his body, of his athletic gifts, and some of what I wanted to do, what I try to do in the time, because I do, you know, I'm fortunate to be able to sit down and talk with guys, but I try to write a little bit less sometimes about the athletic gifts and a little bit more about sort of what's in them. And with him, I think that, you know, with a player who, you know, for all his athletic gifts, he really runs the floor. He scraps. He does not, you know, he does not carry himself like a guy who's just going to jog down and post up and score 30. I mean, he fights for his points, and a lot of his points are off effort plays. I mean, a lot of you don't even know. You look up and you're like, wow, he's got 20. You know, what did that come off? It came off, you know, a lot of junk, putbacks, and, you know, picking up a loose ball and putting it back in. And so I think that to me, that is interesting about him, that somebody who has as many physical gifts as he does still sort of, you know, strives or grinds the way he does.
It's interesting that you brought that up, when you said it wasn't so long ago that he was a nobody. And I wonder if, and you said that, you know, he can clearly remember a time when he was a nobody. It's because it wasn't that long ago. And so, you know, it's still fresh in his mind that he was, you know, that he wasn't that highly touted or anything like that. And so it's easy for him to reflect on that, because I wonder if, like, he still has some of that mentality almost.
I mean, his high school team won, I think they won, I can't remember what it was. I think they won like 6 games his junior year, 5 games his senior year. I wrote them the story. I mean, they were kind of a disaster. I mean, he didn't even go to one of the big, like, the big division schools in Chicago. I mean, he was literally an overnight sensation. He joined his AAU team. He stopped playing AAU after 8th grade. He joined them end of his junior year. He goes out. It was Mean Streets in Chicago. Sorry, I thought he was in Oakland. Mean Streets in Chicago. He joins that team. And, like, in his first game with them, one of the Chicago kind of scout, a very young guy, Daniel Poneman, who wasn't even in college yet, takes a video of him and posts it on his Facebook account. People see it, and he exploded from there. I mean, he literally overnight, he was getting this scholarship offer. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's no doubt he remembers that time clearly. And I think, you know, what I try to get him to, you know, I try to get him to kind of talk about sort of still thinking of yourself that way. You know, a lot of us, we still think of ourselves as in a different time as where we are right now. You know, sometimes I'll have somebody ask me, like, you know, how old are you? And I'll say, oh, I'm 24. And I'll just check myself, and I'll be like, what are you talking about? I'm 37 years old. But a lot of I still think of myself as a different age. And I think that, and Monty Williams said this about Anthony, is that he still thinks of himself that way. And if he can still think of himself that way, you know, as a junior in high school, then they really got something. Because then you've got a guy who is a superstar, has superstar gifts, but still thinks of himself as not a superstar. And isn't that really the key? I mean, it seems like for all these guys, it's like, you know, having that little bit of insecurity in you to kind of keep working, keep adding, you know, keep pushing it, you know, and I think that drives a lot of players. I don't know if it's fear of failure or fear of losing kind of their standing or thinking of themselves as maybe not quite as good as they are, but that's the key. I mean, it just seems like in the NBA where you have so much talent, that's so much of the key. It's just that the slightest edge.
That's really interesting that you said insecurity instead of humility, because I thought you were going to go with humility, but insecurity really, I think, works more there.
Yeah, it's a humility, but I think it is a little bit of insecurity. It's like, yeah. You know, I hear these stories about Kobe, you know, working out. I mean, I don't know, some of it's probably myth, some of it's probably real, but like, you know, these stories about working out at 4 a.m, it's like that. Well, you know, what drives a person to do that? Yeah, I know he wants to be the best and, you know, win as much as he can. But I think there's probably a little bit of, you know, you don't want the next guy to catch you. You know, I think once you lose that, that probably is when the next guy catches you. And so for Davis, I think, you know, the hope is that he stays that person and nobody catches him for a while.
I want you to be honest about this. There's this line that you had in the piece. He is the invention of a god who already built Kevin Durant and decided to get more creative. How proud of you? How proud of that line were you? Be honest.
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah, when I read that, I was like, the whole time I was thinking about Durant with him, just because when you meet him, when you sit with like Durant or you sit with Davis, you sometimes have to check yourself and be like, this person is so distinctive looking. You know, it's like the way, like he reached out to shake my hand and it's almost like he's in the other side of the room. And sometimes it's just fun. You know, one of the fun things about, you know, our job and getting to cover the NBA is you're just seeing people who look, you know, they look supernatural. I mean, it's so interesting, even, you know, even just their appearance. And so, you know, I feel like that with Durant when I'm around him, I just feel like I consider myself sometimes or other people like, wow, you know, God got really creative with this guy, with Durant. And so when I met Davis and I shook his hand for the first time and it really did feel like he was in a different zip code, it made me think about Durant. And so that's where I kind of was thinking, you know, this feels like, you know, the guy didn't want to get more creative. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't like to make good lines. Sometimes, you know, a lot of guys on our, like who I write with in our magazine, they're like, they're rolling out lines like that every other paragraph. So if I can get one, you know, one in the story, I'll be pretty happy.
I can just imagine you, because if I wrote that line, I'd like take a pause and do like a little bit of like a fist pump or something like that. Just like, yeah, I nailed that line.
It's funny because I actually asked my wife. I said, hey, I like this line. What do you think? And she kind of was like shrugged or something. I don't know, something different or something. And I was like, wow. But then I got plenty of love on Twitter for it, so I'm very grateful.
We've talked about this before when you came on last time, but you started this article with a story. You started it and ended it both with an anecdote. Why did you decide to go that route?
I always do. I almost always do. And it's probably a crutch, and I probably shouldn't even do that as much as I do it. But a lot of times I just feel like you know, I just sit down at the end and think, you know, what's the best thing I got? What's the thing if I'm sitting down with my friends, you know, having a beer, and they say, like, what was it like with Nick Young? There's no way I wouldn't say I was in Nick Young's Ferrari, and we went to get Iggy's Christmas present in a parking lot of the Hilton Garden Inn. There's just no way. If a buddy of mine said, what was it like, that's what I'm starting with every time. Yeah, like, it was cool. It's funny that he has a shoe house and shoe keepers, and the arena stories were funny. But there's just no doubt that that's what I would tell my friend if they said, what was it like spending the day with Nick Young? And I think that's kind of my purpose. Like, I get this access. I'm lucky enough to get it. The situation, like, I had with Young, and I owe people what I would think would be the best, you know, most entertaining part of the day. With Davis, you know, I like that story. The story was about him. It was about him watching a game, his career high point game, the game in Utah. I get 43, watching it with friends the next day. I thought it was interesting, first of all, the game wasn't broadcast in New Orleans. He took him over and screened it at his house. And what I liked about it is they were all kind of oohing and aahing over him. And he was, you know, harping on this one play. He messed up. I can't remember the exact play. But he gave up a dunk on it. And he kind of was watching it over, and the friends were wondering why. Him feeling awkward as they were, you know, going crazy over him and gushing over him. I liked it for a few reasons. One is the world is gushing over Anthony Davis. And when I wrote the story, even more than, it was in early December, people were really gushing over him. I mean, the love for him was like probably what Durant had in 2010 or LeBron. He was kind of just turning a corner in Cleveland. So it's kind of sickening in some ways. And, like, I liked that it showed that he wasn't really getting caught up in it. That he was sort of looking at the things he could do better. And I also liked that it kind of teased that notion of him sort of still thinking of himself as not all that. And so it kind of got, I felt like it kind of got me where I needed to go. But again, sometimes it's like you're just, sure, what's the best thing I have? You know, what's the most vivid, the most human? So in that case, that was the best thing I had. And with the Nick Young one, it was a little bit more colorful.
Yeah. And it was, like you said, it was obvious. That was, of course, what you were going to start with. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like, it wasn't even a great, I didn't have a great, like, kicker out of it or anything. It was just kind of, you know, I can remember telling the managing editor of our magazine, Chris Stone, and he's like, well, dude, Nick Young, I told him, I'm grappling with what to lead with. And he said, well, what'd you do? And then I told him that story, and he kind of like, this conversation is over. you have to start with, you know, whenever you're, and that's just kind of one of those, you know, you're a little player, you're in a Ferrari, you're buying a present for Iggy, you know, you just kind of don't overthink it too much at that point.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you about before I let you go, this is kind of topical since you're just at the Cavs practice, but this summer when you broke the LeBron story, that was a huge moment because everyone was wondering where he was going to go and no one really knew. There was tons of rumors and everything was flying about. Did you realize how big of a moment that was, that you were going to be the one to break that?
Yeah, no, I mean, you definitely realize. I guess I didn't realize, you know, how big a deal it was and quite how big until right after. But no, I definitely knew it was a big thing. It was a little different than what I would normally do, which is like, you know, I write generous features about players and write about them. I don't usually write in their voice or that kind of approach that, you know, where he was, it was his words and I was kind of stitching them together. It was different, but it was an extraordinary situation. So I felt like, you know, an extraordinary device was okay or appropriate. But no, it was, you know, it was definitely one of those, you know, one of those days you look back on and remember. At this point, I don't know how many people are remembering it too fondly. I probably will, just because it was, you know, he's been the best player of the era here. And, you know, to be honest, the stories I like better are all the other ones I've gotten to do with him. I mean, I've interviewed him, I think, 5 or 6 times and, you know, pretty extensive sit downs. And he is the stage where he can really reflect on his career, on his unique path. He's extremely insightful. So even though this was, the delivery on this was different, every interview with him is something that I kind of come away from thinking, it was an experience where I learned more about basketball. I learned more about the best player of the era, and that's always really rewarding.
Were you surprised at the fact that you, I mean, that they approached you and that you were going to be the one to write this?
Well, actually, I mean, I sent it to them. I said, when Jabari Parker came out, made himself eligible for the draft, he did this. And Jason Collins had also done it when he announced he's gay. And so I threw it out as kind of an option. And I said, you know, it was not a typical format, but it's something our magazine's been doing a little bit, and it's an option that's available. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a long shot because there's just such a feeding frenzy over it. But I've had lucky enough to do, you know, a few with them. And I think sometimes, you know, not having a camera crew and, you know, a ton of, you know, lighting and, you know, a big machine around you can help. You know, when I talk to it, just me and my tape recorder. And I think, you know, sometimes for a subject, especially in the midst of something like that, you know, maybe that's an advantage.
What was the, and I think you've talked about this before, but what was the turnaround time between that interview and that story going to publication?
Yeah, it was less than 24 hours. It was less than 24 hours. It was not too much less, but it was less than 24 hours. And I would have talked to him on, would have been that Thursday, and then the thing posted on Friday morning. So it wasn't long, but it also was, you know, like I got on a plane and went to Cleveland on Friday. You know, I knew I was just going to Cleveland, so I just went right to the airport and like posted it from the airport, got on the plane, went to Cleveland. And that story that weekend, which was a cover story for the magazine, was way harder. I mean, the one with him was, you know, he said it, and I just kind of stitched together what he said in an order that I thought, you know, would make sense, it would resonate. And, you know, it was probably no different than somebody who's writing kind of a, you know, one of those first person autobiography type deals.
So right.
It was different for me, but in some ways, you know, it was a lot simpler of a process than a normal story where you're talking to, you know, 20 people or something.
So it wasn't like you were sitting on this big story for like a week, just waiting to tell someone, but you couldn't.
Well, yeah, so it wasn't, I mean, yeah, I mean, for those hours, for that, like, whatever it would have been, 15 hours, you know, that the world didn't know and I did know. It's weird because it goes against every instinct you have as a journalist, which is you learn something, you let it be known. And, you know, to not be able to do that was highly awkward and, you know, a little bit uncomfortable. But again, it's such an extraordinary situation. And I obviously wouldn't have been in that position without, you know, kind of this sort of unusual arrangement. So, you know, you do different things in a moment like that, I guess.
Well, Lee, thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate you having me, man.
All right. Talk to you soon.